It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, regarding the pain of others. One of the best war photographers in the world, Anya Niedringhaus, was shot and killed in Afghanistan recently. And in the wake of her death, we're thinking about the courage of photographers who risk their lives to cover war, and about the power of the photographs they take. Why do they take them, and why do we look at them? The late Susan Sontag thought about that question for much of her life. Steve Paulson talked with her about one of her last and most famous essays called Regarding the Pain of Others. It's the one in which she asks, does war photography prevent or encourage war?
All war photography is susceptible, available to being used for organizing against war. But I don't think it has to have that impact at all, because I think in certain contexts you see these images as, look at the terrible things the enemy is doing to us. We must fight even harder to repel the enemy. I think to a Palestinian, looking at images of the destruction of the center of the refugee camp in Jenin, these are not anti-war images. These are images which promote militancy.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you point out that many of the classic war photographs over the decades were actually staged. I mean, going back to Matthew Brady during the Civil War, a lot of those pictures of dead bodies were, the bodies were rearranged to make them look especially graphic, I guess you could say. And other classic photos were staged as well. The American soldiers planting the flag at Iwo Jima. That was a recreation of an actual event.
Well, you know, I think that the understanding of photography almost from the beginning was that it was something that was posed. To begin with, it was because exposure time was quite lengthy by our standards. It could be up to 15 seconds under certain light conditions, as long as a minute. So it was understood that photographs were posed. And I think the notion that photographs should be of an absolutely unguarded moment, as if the photographer is a spy catching something, an event or situation or person, unaware of being observed, is a much later notion. You mentioned the iconic World War II photograph of the raising of the flag in Iwo Jima. Now, of course, there was a raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. It happened in the morning. The photographer, who was an army photographer, had people perform the event again, soldiers, later in the afternoon, with a much bigger flag. That's the interesting detail. If you actually look at the flag in that famous picture, it does seem awfully big for soldiers to be carrying around. And, of course, it makes a much handsomer picture.
Does that bother you? I mean, doesn't that seem wrong to do something like
that? Oh, I think it bothers everybody. But the standard that a picture should not be tampered with, I think that's been slow in evolving. Now I think people would be extremely intolerant of that kind of thing. But there are two pivotal moments, I think, in the history of war photography. One is the Spanish Civil War, where for the first time a war was covered by photojournalists, most famously Robert Capa, who had cameras that were portable. Before that, photography was basically the camera on a tripod. So the photographer was not going into the thick of battle. But once the portable Leica and film that could shoot 36 images before reloading was developed, you had the photographer going into battle and producing images which really set the standard for what war photography could be. That was, on the whole, very partisan photography. The famous images from the Spanish Civil War are all from photojournalists who were on one side, namely the Republican side. They were against the fascist rebellion led by Franco, which did, in fact, triumph. In the Vietnam War, I think that was a second turning point, where, again, most all of the photography was taken by partisan people who sympathized with the sufferings of the Vietnamese and of the American soldiers, and they were not for the war. And a lesson was learned from the Vietnam War by governments making war that one must not let the photojournalists have free rein.
And you don't see that anymore. I mean, in the first Persian Gulf War, there are very few pictures of actual combat.
Actually, the model for that was in an even earlier war, a small war waged by Prime Minister Thatcher. And when the British Expeditionary Force was dispatched to Argentina to recapture some islands off Argentina that the British owned, Thatcher essentially forbade journalistic coverage or controlled it so thoroughly They have virtually no battle scenes or scenes of the carnage and the deaths that were caused in that war.
Now, you mentioned Vietnam, and the ethics get really complicated. And for instance, there's a famous picture, I think it was in 1968, of a South Vietnamese policeman shooting a Viet Cong suspect. And the picture is, I mean, it's unforgettable. It's the moment of death as the bullet is entering the body. But apparently that was, in a sense, staged as well. I mean, that policeman waited for the journalist to assemble before he executed this guy.
That's right. And people often say, well, why doesn't the photographer intervene? You know, the photographers are very often accused of being voyeurs, of photographing something when perhaps they could have prevented it from happening. I think that that's a very unfair accusation because in these situations, I don't think the photographer could prevent the event. Maybe I shouldn't say photographers. The public for war photography obviously particularly prizes and finds particularly memorable photographs taken at the moment of death. It's like a whole separate category of war photographs. There's a fabulous example, totally memorable. It's three photographs taken by Tyler Hicks, a marvelous photojournalist who covered the war in Afghanistan in late 2001 for the New York Times. And he shows in three photographs, kind of triptych, the murder of a captured Taliban soldier, a wounded soldier, actually, who's been dragged out of a ditch. He's already wounded, very severely wounded, and is then butchered by advancing Northern Alliance soldiers. And it's absolutely horrible images to look at. Now, what do you feel when you look at that? One's feelings are, I think, are so complicated, Steve, because I mean, who of us is sympathetic to the Taliban? How can we be sympathetic to the Taliban? It's one of the most atrocious and despotic movements in modern history.
But there is another
side
to this.
This is a human being.
I mean,
this is a human being.
It's a human being. It's horrible. I don't think anyone can look at those kinds of pictures without feeling horror. But yet, on the other hand, there is a certain thrill. I mean, it's the dirty little secret about what we're talking about. There's a kind of voyeuristic appeal to seeing some of the carnage at times, not always, but at times. It's the reason why, you know, we often slow down as we're driving by a car wreck to try to catch a glimpse of what happened.
It's absolutely true that there is a voyeuristic impulse in many people, in most people, and they will slow down to look at the car wreck and then say, wasn't that terrible? We are attracted in some way to these images. The basis on which we're attracted is rather complicated. Maybe it's that we want to experience that we are safe. You see, if I can go back to the idea of the whole book regarding the pain of others, what does the title mean? It means we are safe, and we are looking at something happening to other people, but we're not there. We're here. We're here looking at a magazine or a newspaper. We're in front of our television sets. We're looking at images on our computer. And the terrible things are happening somewhere else. So why do we want to look at them? First of all, we think we ought to look at them maybe. We have an obligation to look at them, to know what the world is really like. Maybe we have a particular identification with this struggle or a particular interest in it. Maybe we're testing ourselves to see if we really can look at terrible things like a kind of ordeal. But I think in all of these experiences, something is happening, which I think is real at the same time, very questionable, that it's there and it's not here. And if you're just looking at it, you're not responsible.
In a sense, it removes us from the suffering. And I don't want to overplay this, but we can perhaps feel a little more virtuous by going through the pain of looking at these, but yet also in the back of our minds, we know that's not us. I mean, we're safe. We're innocent.
One, it's not happening to us, and two, we're not doing it. Now, the second assertion may be a little questionable. I mean, if your country has gone to war with another country, do you have a responsibility to oppose that war? I think that the images tend to make us feel passive, but I don't think, as I used to think that they necessarily desensitize us. I think they only desensitize us when we're told this is an age-old conflict, there's absolutely nothing to be done about it, it's hopeless. Then I think you have, you know, say, oh, that again, and you switch the channel. But if you have been told that something can happen, something can be different, if you have another political context, I think these images can be very mobilizing, and I don't think you get used to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I think we tend to feel these days that given the reach of the modern media, that we see everything. We see all the horrors, but that's actually not true. I mean, we don't
no,
see
I think the world
the worst of it. Going back to the September 11th attacks, we saw repeatedly the plane smashing into the World Trade Center. We saw almost no images of dead bodies. And you know, clearly, they were there, but people chose not to show those.
Yes, there was a great deal of largely self-censorship, which, of course, is the most powerful form of censorship of the images of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. There are virtually no images of the destruction of the Pentagon and of the people who were killed there. And there were a lot of photographs that were taken, this is well known, of very gruesome things at the World Trade Center. And what was the reason that the people who control the media gave about this? This isn't helpful. Or something you hear very often, this is not in good taste.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm very suspicious when people talk about good taste as a reason for not showing something. It's felt to be unpatriotic. It's felt to be demoralizing. There are all sorts of reasons.
Well, the other reason that's often given is it would be disrespectful to the families of the dead, that somehow it would be dishonoring the memory.
Yes, but that's because Americans have the rather obscene habit of thinking that American lives are worth more than anybody else's lives, and American lives have an entirely different value than other people's lives. We don't have a problem about showing foreign dead. We have a problem showing American dead. Mm.
And it is true that you almost never see the face of a dead American.
Well, those Civil War photographs that were taken by the Brady team on the battlefields of Antietam and Gettysburg did show faces, and they were extremely shocking. They were really breaking a taboo. But by and large, notions of disrespect to survivors is a reason often given that we don't show bad things that happen to Americans. But we have no problem about showing bad things that happen to people abroad, particularly people in Asia or Africa, as if those people didn't have relatives and as if those people couldn't confront those images. I think, again, of the soldier, the Taliban soldier who's butchered in the Tyler Hicks pictures. I don't think it's unlikely that his family saw those images. People are online in Afghanistan. They have access to these images, but we don't think about that. Americans tend not to think about other people being human beings with families in the same way that we think about ourselves.
The late Susan Sontag talking with Steve Paulson about her last book, Regarding the Pain of Others. Some of the most disturbing and also compelling photographs of death that I've seen are by a photographer named Sarah Sudoff. If you see them from a distance, on a gallery wall, you'd think they're abstracts. They're big prints, with deep, rich reds and browns, blotchy, kind of organic shapes. But they're actually close-ups of bloodstains. Sarah calls the series At the Hour of Our Death. Sarah, do you have a favorite photograph from At the Hour of Our Death?
Yes. It's called Suicide with Gun, Female, 60 Years Old. It's actually a portion of a mattress bisected down the middle. There's stains all over it, but there's particularly some red splotches, and the mattress has now turned yellow from the stain of urine.
It's beautiful, as are all your photographs, but, well, I guess it's disturbing that they're beautiful. They're beautiful and dark at the same time. Is that what you're aiming to do?
I think with this series, I'm very interested in getting under your skin a little bit, to raise questions in your mind, to make you curious, to make you possibly step back for a second. The few times that I have exhibited the work, if I can choose to, I don't often put the text or the title next to the piece. I just have the photograph up, so it's a little bit ambiguous as to what it is, drawing you in, the saturated color, the abstractness. Ideally, the prints are 30 by 40 inches. So the fragment or swatch that I'm photographing is very much enlarged from its actual size.
So you're not just looking at a photograph of a bloodstain. It's a gigantic, enlarged bloodstain.
Yes, it's about the size of me. I'm just over 5 feet tall, so it's close to my size and scale. And most of the material is quite small, a throw pillow or a portion of a mattress, like I said before, or a bed sheet. And then I'm using a macro lens and going in really tight and detailed on just a small section.
What does it feel like to be handling that stuff? I mean, what's your attitude while you're doing it? You're, you know, touching and photographing the cellular remains of someone mm-hmm. who died violently. A lot of people would find that terribly disturbing.
It is, and the camera provides a nice shield or provides a nice distance between you and what you're photographing. You can sort of hide behind it. But after a year of working on this project, it started to affect me a lot more. Initially, curiosity just took over. And then the longer that I've sat with it, the more that I've thought about it and talked about the work, it is a bit disturbing.
Do you feel, I don't know, a sense of reverence? Is there a way in which when you're handling some of these objects, they feel like sacred objects?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I am conscious that it is the cellular residue of someone. I don't know who this person is. I don't know anything more about them than, you know, possibly how they died. But I do feel that I need to be respectful. That's just a personal thing to me, that I'm being as careful as I can be.
I'm just thinking that so often in our culture, you know, we like to pretend that death doesn't happen or that it mm-hmm. can be tidy. And here you are asking us to confront, beautifully maybe, but still to confront death. What kind of reactions do you get from people who see your work?
It runs the whole gamut. A lot of people are moved by the work. I get a lot of people who think I'm exploiting the people who have died. For the most part, the responses have been very positive. People may find them beautiful in their abstract quality and not want to engage any further with the work. And then other people who do want to enter in and have a dialogue about death and dying and traces. We have a great conversation.
Why do you think this interest has stayed with you for so long?
I'm not sure. I have a few ideas. I come from a military family. And my father went to the Gulf War. When he came back, he showed me videos of what he saw and what it was like to be on the ground there. And, you know, whether or not a 13-year-old should see that, I was definitely exposed to it. I knew about war. I knew about how fragile our bodies were, coupled with the fact that I wanted to be a doctor when I was younger. With my experience with cervical cancer, that sort of interest in the medical realm with illness, with mortality, sort of opened back up and came back to the front.
What does your family think of your work?
My mother would like me to take pictures of dogs and cats and, you know, sunsets. I think my dad understands my work better than my mother. They both are appreciative and they're both supportive, but it is a challenge.
You have a new baby.
I do.
When he's old enough to see your work for the first time, what do you think you'll say to him about it? How will you explain it?
I guess the easiest way to talk about it is when I was an undergraduate, I attended a lecture by photojournalists, and they were talking about the role of the photographer and the role of the camera. They said that photographers are like flashlights. They bring light to the darkness. I've loved that idea of revealing something to the world that other people would rather not look at or possibly have looked over. So I guess I would tell my son that the projects that I work on are issues that most people wouldn't want to look at or think about, but that I feel are relevant and important to share with the world. I feel like I have a duty.
I'm curious, has there ever been a photo you've taken that's just been too much, too powerful, too raw?
My older project, Repository, when I was photographing in the hospital, I had never had access to a hospital like this before, and so was photographing anything. Yeah, I was very curious. And one day in the histology lab, the technician that I was working with mentioned that amputation had just occurred, and he pulled the leg out for me to look at. Of course, I was curious and wanted to look, and I photographed it. And even though that I know the person lived because the leg had been removed, they had diabetes and there was gangrene, looking at that detached leg was so disturbing. Aesthetically, it was beautiful. I shot it on this cutting board that they use in the histology lab that under the fluorescent lights turned green. The skin was moist. There was purple and red, and then the white of the bone sticking out of the leg. It was beautiful and very haunting, and one of the only things that I've ever photographed that made me cry.
That's photographer Sarah Sudoff talking about her collection called At the Hour of Our Death. If you want to see some of those photos, you can visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. This hour, we're talking with photographers who use their skill and art to bear witness to human suffering. So how do they themselves deal with what they see or don't see? William Christenberry is a noted American photographer. He spent 4 decades taking pictures of the place he grew up, the back roads and empty shacks of Hale County, Alabama. It's a landscape of economic hardship, but there was one day, one place in particular, where the pain caught up with him.
I had been photographing, actually right up the street from the Barbecue Inn, another country store. And no one was around. It was kind of strange. It was a very quiet day. And I'm under the dark cloth, that is with the big camera, focusing. And I heard no footsteps, nothing. And when I took the cloth off my head, right to my left, it startled me. It didn't scare me, but startled me, was this man. And he was beautiful, purple-black skin, as you see so often in African-American people in the Deep South, purple-black. And he was dressed in a white short-sleeve starch shirt, white starch, white pants, white shoes, freshly polished, and a big wide-brim white hat. And he said to me, "You like that old building, son?" I said, "Yes, sir." "You ought to see my house." More out of courtesy, I said, "Well, sir, when I finish here, I'd be pleased to see your house." So in a few minutes, I'd finished and broke down the camera and put everything in the car, and he got in beside me, and he says, "Just down that road, about 2 miles. And I started down the road, and then I noticed that his left arm was missing from right below the cuff of the shirt, but I didn't say anything. And in a minute, he says to me, "Pull over on the shoulder of the road, son. That's my house. I built that house with one arm." So we got out, and he wanted to show me inside. And we went in the back door, which was fine, little red earth path back to the back door. And then my heart really sank because there was no floor. It was just red earth. And a beat-up old mattress over in one corner, some broken chairs. And we chatted a little while, just made small talk. And I said, "Sir, do you mind if I photograph your house?" He said, "Oh, I'd be so pleased. Yes, please, I would be happy for you to. Please." So I went out and set up the big camera, the 8x10, in front of the house, and I made the picture. And I thanked him and left, thanked him profusely. And I drove away, and when we got back to Washington a week or so later and I saw the proof print, it was okay. Technically, it was sound, properly focused, decently composed, but it did not resonate with what I'd experienced there. Now, let me be the first to say, I don't know if it's possible for me or anyone else to have captured that moment. Maybe a poet, certainly a poet could write about this. So I said to myself, well, I'll go back next year. Next year, pretty much to the same day. I get there and I get out of the car and I start walking down that little red earth path. And a man next door to my right came rushing across the lawn, rushing. And he stopped at the fence edge and he said, "You looking for Mr. So-and-so?" I said, "Yes, sir." He died. He froze to death last winter. And I've never been able to go back there.
William Christenberry is a noted American photographer. His work has been the subject of solo exhibitions at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, Aperture Gallery, and many others. His most recent book of photographs is called simply William Christenberry. Photographer Michael Nye spent 4 years photographing mentally ill and homeless people in San Antonio, where he lives. He wanted his subjects to have their own voice, so he also recorded their stories.
I think everyone has a wisdom about their own experience. They know something that no one else knows. And so the stories really are about those kinds of wisdoms, what only Jerry experienced or Doris or Beth experienced about their own personal histories.
You mentioned Beth. Now, her childhood experiences left her with permanent post-traumatic stress disorder, and somehow you capture that in your photograph of her. Could you describe it?
She's in a garden. She, growing up, was one of the most talented writers in her high school, and she performed her own songs on stage. So as a child, she was beaten, sexually abused, and she's literally stayed in one chair in her kitchen for years. And in her narrative, she speaks about kindness and the concept of hush and libraries. It's very beautiful. But in the photograph, she's in a garden, and she's standing against a white wall inside corner, and she's standing on ivy. It's thick and green. And although the photograph's in black and white, and I took the picture in late afternoon, and the sun was low, and the wind was blowing, and behind us was a large pecan tree, and so the shadows are, the branches and leaves were constantly in motion. And for me, what was beautiful about the image was the quality of light. There's a glow, white light on white wall, and white on light gray. And Beth is standing in a long dress with her right hand gently holding the side of the wall.
My favorite place to be is a place that I'm most safe. It's a corner in my kitchen, and I've got it fixed up to look like a treehouse. And on my left is a window with plants everywhere, and everything a person would want, books, music, that's in my safe place. I spend 3/4 of my waking life in that safe place. How is it possible to love someone that beats you up, that uses you, that degrades you, I don't understand why a parent would grab a child's hair and twist it around and slam that child into a wall. How a father who's going through a drought of loneliness take one of his children and strip that child of dignity and knowledge and give that child pain. Why would a parent deprive them of food, lock them in a cabinet? Why would that happen? I'd like to wrap my arms around someone, whether my age, older, younger, wrap my arms around someone that is going through this until they finally believe it's not their fault, they're a beautiful person. Kindness is more important than anything else in this world. I think that every philosopher has probably tried to tell us that. That's what it comes down to. What else are we here for but to take care of each other, to nurture the planet? What else are we here for? There's a thing when we're children we experience, it usually exists in libraries, and it's called the hush, like this magic world called hush. There's not many places now to find hush. Sometimes I really do think that if every person would experience hush, even if they almost have to force it on themselves for a while, just the bird, just the wind, nothing else, hush, there would be less violence.
Will you tell me about the photograph of Elizabeth?
I was interviewing Elizabeth about anxiety disorder and agoraphobia, about the fear that she had of leaving her home. And so she called me between interviews. She was trembling, and she said, I just experienced a panic attack. And so through our conversation, I said, is there any way maybe this week you could come over to my studio and maybe go through that experience? And she was so giving and absolutely agreed. She said, let's try to do that. And it was downtown San Antonio on St. Mary Street. It was late in the afternoon. The photograph's late in the afternoon. It was very busy, lots of traffic and cars. I had my large camera set up. It's an old lens, maybe 80 years old, and it didn't cover the negative, so the image is a circle in the rectangle, and around the circle is black. And Elizabeth is leaning up against the wall, and right as I'm taking the picture, a pedestrian turns the corner, and he's in a blur. Only his foot, or maybe his one arm, is in focus. And listening to Elizabeth's story about a panic attack, it's a reminder that we all have our own separate histories. What about his life? What about hers?
It was a cold morning. It was drizzling. I had an appointment to go downtown that morning, and everything was fine. Just a normal day. When I got on the bus, I went to a favorite spot by the window. The first sensation was there was too much noise, too many notes. All of a sudden, everything is flooding my mind. I don't know why I'm going anywhere. I'm not sure someone's not out to get me. I'm going insane. I feel like everyone's thinking, there's that insane person. All this stuff starts flooding my mind. It's horror. Horror. I can hear and feel my heart pounding like it's knocking on my chest wall. My hands are pretty clammy. I was scared. I was afraid they would be afraid of me. I had no control over my tears, so I got on the floor of the bus so I could hide for a while, hoping this would pass. I was crying. It's just terrifying. So humiliating. No dignity. Afraid to look into anyone's eyes. Then I got interrupted. The bus driver said I needed to get off the bus. Miss, you need to get off the bus now. You're causing a disruption. I didn't feel like I could move. I was two people. I made myself get up off the floor and slowly walked to the front of the bus and got off. When I got off the bus, there was a telephone pole, and I went over to it and held on to it. until I felt stable. That's what it feels like to go through this. That's what a panic attack feels like.
This might be kind of an odd question, having heard how much pain a lot of your subjects have experienced in their lives, but if you could wipe out mental illness tomorrow, would you do so? I guess I'm wondering, is there a function for this kind of sadness, this kind of pain? Do we need these people in some way in our culture?
Well, as I've talked about earlier, the 60 people in the exhibit, I see them as teachers, you know, not as people with mental illness. They are helping us. There is a function. We can understand more about ourselves, more about humanity, the questions that Immanuel Kant asked. So we do need them for understanding, for insight, for courage. I found myself being inspired over and over. So I do think we need to listen to people that have been challenged in their lives. I remember Virginia Woolf's, in her diary, she says that we need to look at the landscapes of our life and we can find that pain and sorrow reveal some truths.
Yes. Oh, yes. I listen to this song over and over and over and over again, as many times as I can. Sometimes 10, 15 hours a day. I feel stronger when I hear the music. I feel normal. Those are the feelings that I have.
Photographer Michael Nye's documentary exhibition is called Fine Line, Mental Health, Mental Illness. So far, it's traveled to more than 30 cities. If you'd like to see some of those photos, visit our website at ttbook.org. That about wraps up our conversation on photography and pain. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have another interview in our National Poetry Month series, and also a dangerous idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Diane Halpern, Dean of Social Sciences at the Minerva Schools at the Keck Graduate Institute and Professor of Psychology at Claremont McKenna College. I'm also the author of Sex Differences in Cognitive Abilities. What's a dangerous idea? Well, here's one: the ability to choose the sex of your own baby. Why is it so dangerous? It's dangerous because it's fraught with all sorts of gray areas that allows people to really gloss over the ethical issues that are involved in these sorts of decisions. It is now medically possible to choose the sex of your as-yet unconceived babies every year for decades. I've asked students in my college classes if they could actually plan in advance, what would they have, how many children, how many males, how many females. And repeatedly over many countries, over many decades, the modal response is two. Most people want a boy followed by a girl. If they want one child, it's more often a boy. If they want three, they want boy, girl, boy. And yet, these are certainly not a representative sample of the population. This is a group that's more likely to be egalitarian in their attitudes than general population. And if they were to get exactly what they wanted, we would soon have an excess of males, and all those traits that are associated with being firstborn or only children would be, in fact, correlated with being male. Economists would argue, well, the economy will be such that it will be balanced out later with girls. But in fact, research has shown that so far, that's simply not been true. In other countries in the world, such as China and India, we already know we have a huge excess of males now that couples are able to predetermine the sex of their child. You might say, well, those are in other countries. What about the U.S.? The evidence is more subtle, but the preference for sons is still strong. We see it in a variety of ways. Couples that have two girls are more likely to have a third child than couples that have two boys. So this makes this a dangerous idea. But perhaps the even greater dangerous idea would be trying to stop advances in medical science or giving these choices over to the government. I'm guessing that many listeners of childbearing age would want to choose the sex of their yet unconceived child and see no problems with this practice. Well, what if you could also choose their intelligence, their height, their eye color? Should that be allowed as well? Few things are in life are as appealing as the possibility of a perfectly balanced family, which in modal response would be an older son and a younger daughter, an improved version that looks just like you.
That's Diane Halperin's Dangerous Idea. You'll find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, we, along with everyone else, are mourning the death of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the great Colombian novelist and Nobel laureate. He was the writer who gave us 100 Years of Solitude with that perfect opening line. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. I read that for the first time in English, as many people do, and that's thanks in part to his longtime translator, Edith Grossman. Steve Paulson talked with her back in 2006.
Love in the Time of Cholera was the first one I did, and I think that came out in English in 87 or 88.
And you've translated all of his books since then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you're working on one of his books, do you consult with him at all?
Only at the very end. Practically everyone I've translated is a living author. But I don't consult with them, for the most part, until I have exhausted all the dictionaries at my disposal, and I've exhausted all of my Latino friends, and there are still problematic words or phrases, and then I ask the author what was intended. I don't ask for a translation, but what the intention is with that phrase, and then I figure out how to translate it.
Now, he has said, you are his voice in English.
Yeah, he's very kind.
Is he a good person to work with?
Oh, he's lovely. He's a charmer. I adore him.
You know, it must be strange to think about how in some ways your translations of much of Garcia Marquez's work, for instance, I mean, that's how the English language world knows him in a way. It's through your translations. And I guess I'm wondering if in some ways, I mean, obviously it's his world that you're creating, but whether you feel in some ways a co-creator of his books as they're read in English.
I don't think I would say that. But there's no question in my mind as to who created it. the responsibility of being someone's voice in English is enormous, not only Garcia Marquez, but any writer whose work I translate. I'm awestruck sometimes about at the responsibility that I do have for their work in English.
I want to ask you a little bit about Garcia Marquez. I mean, obviously so much has been written about him. Many people would consider him the greatest living writer in the world right now. When you look at the way he wrote, what distinguishes his writing, do you think? What does he do that's sort of different or unusual?
I think his artistic awareness is very intense and very acute. And he's very Cervantian in that way. His sentences are beautifully structured. Their rhythms are very subtle. The way a paragraph moves, the way one sentence flows into another sentence is really quite gorgeous. It's quite terrific.
Well, I read something that you had written. One thing that Garcia Marquez does is he has very precise physical descriptions, and that's often his way into a story.
Yeah, I really don't know if that's exclusively his, but yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. He does focus on the exterior of everything. He does almost no psychological or emotional analysis of a character. Everything we know about them comes from the outside in, and in that respect, he's very 19th century. The realists, the European realists, did that as well. They started with the outside and did very detailed, minute descriptions of furniture and the bricks and that houses were made of and the clothing that people were wearing and their hairstyles and the lines on their faces and so forth. And even when the psychological impact of what he's writing is very acute, he does not do psychology. He does physical characteristics. And that's amazing to me. But I don't think that's unique. I don't think he's unique, I mean, in doing that.
But it must take great skill to be able to pull that off, to go from the exterior to then reveal so much about what's inside people.
Yeah, I think that's a function of his journalism. I mean, he has said on various occasions that writing journalism is no different from writing fiction, that it's exactly the same skill. And I think he's doing what a reporter does, which is to observe the scene, observe the people in it, and not make any guesses about what's hidden, but only to give all the information possible about what's visible.
Do you think because he has that style, does that allow him to do anything in particular, or does it avoid certain pitfalls?
I think it makes reading his work very interesting because there is no way you can read Garcia Marquez's books and remain passive. If you want to find out what the inner life of a character is, you have to bring all of your experience to it to figure that out, because he is not going to give you any easy information about the interior of those people.
And I suppose he also avoids the pitfall that's so common among many writers, sentimentality.
Yes, he is the least sentimental writer and the most intensely emotional writer that I can think of. And that's, I don't know how he, I can't tell you how he does it, but it's remarkable.
Now, he is, of course, known, for, among other things, for magic realism, he and among a number of other Latin American writers. And a lot of younger Latin American writers have reacted against that, sort of the weight of that tradition, and have very publicly rejected it in some cases. Has the moment of magic realism come and gone, do you think?
I have to make a confession to you. It's a term I despise, and I don't think it gives you any information about anything.
Why do you despise that term?
Well, I don't think it tells you anything. I'm not sure what it's allegedly describing. Writers have used fantasy before to create the illusion of reality. I'm not certain. When I've taught I've told my students that they can say anything they want and use any words they want, except there are two words they can't put together. And those two words are magic realism. So I think it's an easy way out for critics, to say, oh, well, here's another magical piece of magical realism. It's not a term I buy into. I don't think he's very fond of it either.
Just because it's sort of this catchphrase, this all-encompassing.
Well, it's really easy. You know, what is somebody talking about when they say magical realism? That there is fantasy, certainly in 100 Years of Solitude, there are moments of fantasy.
And supernatural occurrences. So,
magical stuff. But he certainly didn't invent that.
It's not just me who's saying this. I mean, there's this whole generation of younger writers coming up reacting.
In Mexico, they're called the crack. It's the crack as the reaction against the boom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it would be surprising if there weren't a younger generation reacting to that. Generations react and turn against older generations. I think it's perfectly expected. It's what one assumes is going to happen. So if they prefer not to write in long extended periods in the kind of the Baroque Cervantian sentences that Garcia Marquez writes, that Carlos Fuentes writes, that Vargas Llosa writes, and are going back to a more Borges kind of spare, clean sentence structure, Borges is the older generation, so if they're returning to it, they've skipped the generation of the fathers and they're returning to the generation of the grandfathers.
Hmm.
Or the grandfather. There aren't many people who wrote the way Borges did.
Mm-hmm. No, Garcia Marquez is, he has said he's going to come out with 3 volumes of his memoirs, is that right?
That's what he's threatened. Yeah. No, he has said that.
And one has come out so far.
Yeah. And I don't know. I asked him, I don't know, about a year ago if he was working on the second volume. And he said it's so damn hard to reconstruct your life that he may take a little rest from it. And I think he did Memories of My Melancholy Whores to replace the second volume. I hope he gets back to his autobiography. The first volume I thought was amazing. It was really a wonderful book.
Well, I hope there's more.
Me too. So do I.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez did not, unfortunately, write another volume of his memoirs. He died this week at age 87. Edith Grossman is the foremost contemporary English translator of Latin American fiction, and she and Steve talked together in 2006. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour, with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music was composed by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.